And I want to thank all of you for your attention, and it's been a pleasure to be here. And thanks to those of you that have fed us, and thanks to Rick and Deborah for putting us up. I went to school with Rick and Deborah, so I knew them years ago. And actually, it was at Deborah's house, the Biddle house there in Gardendale, Alabama, which I used to enjoy going to. It was always a nice place to be. It was one of the first places I ever saw my wife. And it's nice to get to be back with them. And Brian and Megan, who are we know well because Megan grew up in about 3 miles from us up in Pennsylvania, and others of you that I've gotten to meet, and some of you that I've known in the past that I didn't realize it when I first came in, and a chance to be around John and Scott and spend some more time around them. I've known both of them before, but had not gotten to spend as much time. And it's been a pleasure to be here, and I really, really appreciate it. So tonight, we're going to move pretty quick, because in some earlier lessons, I didn't move quick enough. And so the last part here, we can either leave some stuff out or try to do a Paul on a Sunday night. We're not going to do that. And even though there's no third floor windows here, we're not going to do that. Or we can just go through the points quickly, and I'm opting for going through the points quickly. This first one is settling for situation control instead of training the child. Those are two different things. And let me, we're up there on the board. Situation control is when there's a problem, and instead of thinking, what do I need to do to train my child, we're thinking, what can I do to control this situation? Those are two different things. A few of you are familiar with the books by the Pearls about child training, which I don't agree with everything in, but there's some good stuff. I'm going to illustrate it with this little girl right here on the right. Those are my three oldest when they were little. We've still got three at home, but these are the three oldest. That's April, Adam, and the little one there is Brianne, and you're going to hear about her in just a moment. But before that, I'll relate another little story, and it's from the Pearls book. He talks about this kid with a Twinkie, and what happened was there were several boys over, and they're playing. Mom has one boy. It's his house. He comes in, and he picks up a Twinkie, but the problem is there's only one Twinkie. He heads back outside, and he's got a Twinkie, and nobody else is going to have a Twinkie. So every mom here recognizes the problem, right? Okay, so she realizes, we got a problem. He's taking the Twinkie. There's no more for the other kids. So she says, no, you can't have the Twinkie. There's not enough for everybody else. And he decides he's not going to give up the Twinkie. And he keeps the Twinkie. He will not give it back to the mom. She's telling him no. He's disobeying. She's trying to get the Twinkie from him. He won't give it up. He's going like he's going to open the Twinkie. She now is bigger than him and stronger than him, so apparently somewhat of a match ensues in a battle over the Twinkie. I don't know what the Twinkie looked like by the time it was done, but mom eventually has the Twinkie. And then the son goes, think I have a cracker, graham cracker or something? She goes, okay. Now, do you see what she did there? What's she focused on? I can't have him going out there with a Twinkie. Something else happened that was a lot more serious than whether or not somebody's going to get a Twinkie. She told her son what to do. He absolutely defied her, absolutely refused to obey her, absolutely was disrespectful and had to make the mom fight for this. There's a big, big problem there that's much bigger than the Twinkie. She thinks because she got the Twinkie, she solved the problem. There's a huge problem with that boy right there, and that's what he needs mom to deal with, that situation, which is much more serious than the Twinkie. Which brings us back to this little sweetheart stinker right there, Brianne, who is pretty famous for the story I'm about to tell. She'll go places and they'll say, oh, you're the car seat girl. Brianne was the easiest of our six. Of our six, I had three that at one point, either one or three or four, they just decided they were not going to obey. on something usually very small. And I decided they were going to obey. And they decided they weren't. And it was just battle lines drawn. And it was a battle until they did. And then usually after that, just didn't have trouble with them. The other three never went, you know, the nuclear option like that. But, you know, there were episodes now and then. Well, with Brienne, I'd almost never, she was such a good little girl. And if I looked at her, you know, she was, and that was about all she needed from me. Until one day, she decides to go for it. And it went like this. We get in the car. She's got a car seat that she's supposed to sit in and close it. And off we go. So she gets in. I get in. Everybody's in. I'm putting the car in reverse. We're backing up. And April says, Brienne didn't get in her car seat. I said, Brienne, get in your car seat. And she doesn't. Well, I pulled off. I stopped by a little creek. I went out. This is what my mom used to do with me. She'd say, go get a switch. And I got a switch. And I brought it out here. And I brought Brienne out of the car and we had a talk. Remember what his proverbs say? The rod and reproof bring wisdom. And so we talk about why she needs to obey. That it's my job, you know, to teach her to obey. And, you know, and I'm not mad at her, but God gave me a job and she has to obey. And so I give her a lecture about disobeying. And when I get done, I gave her a spanking. And she cried. But it wasn't a real defeated cry. It was that hurt, but we're not done here cry. I said, now get up and get in your car seat. Brienne got up, she got in the car, and she sat down beside her car seat. I brought Brienne back out again. We had the talk again. We had the spanking again. Harder, of course, this time. This time, Brienne got up and she got in the car and she sat down beside the car seat. We came out again. We had the conversation again. Spanked her hard again. This time, she got up, she got in the car and she sat down beside the car seat. We came outside again. We explained how life works again. Spanked her hard again. It took 5 times. It was on the 5th time she finally sat down in the car seat. Later that day, I talked to her and I said, Brienne, I said, why didn't you get in the car seat? Did you think that Daddy would give up? And she went, uh-huh. And that day, my little girl needed to find out that Daddy wasn't going to give up. Now, what would have been simpler for me to do? Yeah, I can take a 3-year-old and put him in a car seat. They can be kicking and screaming and crying. I can put him in a car seat. You can too. Is that training a child? That's not training a child. That's controlling the situation. You know, the state of Pennsylvania says you got to be in a car seat. Listen, when I was little, we didn't have car seats. One of my first memories, apparently, I rode standing up at the dash because one of my first memories, my dad's 59 Plymouth, and instead of the rear view up here, it was down here on the dash. There I am riding along, you know, like this. I survived. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. But there was a bigger situation than her being in the car seat. The bigger situation was she needed to obey. I needed to obey the laws of Pennsylvania, and she needed to obey the laws of Dad. Yes, I could have put her in, but that wouldn't have trained her. She would not have had to submit her will. So remember that settling for situation control is not the same thing as training the child. Proverbs 22 does not say control a child. And when they are old, they will not depart from it. You can control a child, and they can't wait till they're 18 and get out of the house, and they're going to do what they want to do. What does Proverbs 22 say? Train a child in the way they should go. So that way, they've learned self-control. So that way, when they leave the home, they don't need us to be telling them what to do because they've learned self-control, they've learned self-denial, and they want to serve God. Okay, moving on here. Oh, one time on this point, there was a mom in the audience, and a few days later, she said, that was a life-altering point for me. Before, I would take my daughter and I'd just put her in the high chair, you know, whether she wanted it or not. And by the way, sometimes with a baby, there's going to be episodes where, you know, things are going to work a little different before they're able to communicate and stuff as much. But Brianna certainly knew what was going on at her age. But this mom says, I used to just put her in the high chair and that type of thing. So she said, I started doing that. And she said, after 3 days, my daughter is happier and she's obeying. And so it's child training is more than child control. That old thing that we talked about, they're not going to do that under my roof. That's not enough. We want to train children so that they're not disobeying under our roof, under somebody else's roof, or under their roof. We want to help train them. We want to, the Bible says, train up a child in the way he should go. When he's old, he'll not depart from it. And that involves training their hearts. There's the old story about the little boy. I don't know if it was at school or class or somewhere, or Bible class, but he's being told to sit down. He does not want to sit down. Finally, he has to sit down. He goes, okay. As he sits down, he says, but I'm still standing up on the inside. You know, and it's like, we want to train that heart. All right, number 12, mistaking taking them to church for bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. If you brought your children to church today, very good. If you brought your children to Bible class, thank you for doing that. That would be so beneficial. Take advantage of the Bible classes. You know, get your children here. There's lots of other things competing for their attention. And to be able to be with other children and studying the Bible together and learning, take advantage of that opportunity and use that. But please don't think that bringing your children to church equals bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's only part of it. Do you remember Deuteronomy 6? What did it tell the parents to do? It talked about, you know, when you go with them in the way, when you rise up and when you lie down. Who did it say in Ephesians 6 is to train up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? Did it say Bible class teachers train up the children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? No. Fathers do that. This is our job. Use those opportunities at church as, you know, for the benefit that it will give. But that's not enough. Let's think about it this way. Just the Bible classes alone. If they get 45 minutes, say, on a Sunday morning, 45 minutes during the midweek, that's how, a total of what? Hour and a half. The average kid sees more than an hour and a half's worth of commercials in a short period of time, unfortunately. That I would not recommend you let them sit around and watch that much TV. But the fact is, a lot of people do. And they're just all sorts of things are going into their mind all the time. And we're thinking, let's put it this way. Would you feed your child only on Sunday and Wednesday? You know, you take him to Dr. Phoebe, he looks pretty sickly. Oh, he'll be fine. He's wasting away. He'll be fine. When's the last time he ate? Well, let's see, this is Tuesday night. Sunday. Yeah, we took him to dinner on Sunday. What are you doing? Well, we feed him every Sunday and Wednesday. He's going to be malnourished. Plus, one of the really, really sad things, one time I went with a brother to pick up another brother from the hospital, and he was talking with us. I'd never met him before, but he said something really sad. A lot of people know the heartache of their children, and a lot of people in the Bible, a lot of good people in the Bible had sons. You look at David and Absalom. You look at a number of cases. And it's heartbreaking. But this man's statement was heartbreaking too. He said, I've got 4 children. And at the time, they were all in about their 40s or so, from maybe 40s, maybe early 50s. And he said, of all 4 of them, not a single one is faithful. And then he said this, I don't know what happened. We took him to church all those years. And when he said that, you could see what happened. Look at his mystified question. I don't know what happened. We took them to church. That's not raising a child. That's not training a child. That's not bringing them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord and talking about it when you rise up. That's something very important, but it only happens a couple of times a week. Think of all the other influences, from whether it's school or their friends or something, their kids are showing them in the basement of the house next door, or TV, or teachers with some agenda, or other things going on in the neighborhood, and all these things, bam, bam, bam. And then along comes puberty and all these other things, and the parties and the things that people want them to go to and get involved in. It's not going to be enough to say this and this. One other thing. Do not teach your children to be faithful to the church. Teach your children to be faithful to the Lord. Churches, a church that today is faithful, you don't know what it might be 10 or 20 years from now. Look at the church at Laodicea. At one time, it's this church. You remember when Paul wrote the letter to it and everything? A few years later, when the Lord addresses it, what does he say? You are lukewarm, and I will spew you out of my mouth. Repent. Now, what if the parents in that church taught their children, whatever you do, be like the church at Laodicea? What would they have been? Yeah, and ready to be what? Spewn out. We are people who have sinned against God, who need God's mercy and need God's rules. We need to follow our Savior. If we start following each other and lose sight of the Good Shepherd, it won't do any good how loyal we are to each other on the broad way. We need to be on the narrow way with Christ. When we teach our children to be faithful to the Lord, if they serve the Lord, whose people will they be? The Lord's people, the Lord's church. And who will they want to associate with and not forsake their assembling with? The Lord's people, the Lord's church. And what will they help build up? The Lord's people, the Lord's church. But the loyalty doesn't start with us. The loyalty starts with the Lord. Let's move on to the next point. Number 13, thinking if we don't allow this, they might rebel and leave the church. It's like, well, he's really getting into that, you know, this particular band that's famous for, say, its drug use or its death message or its promotion of homosexuality or whatever else. Well, I think it's faith. Well, he's really getting into it. You know, all he's thinking about is that concert he's going to go to. Well, I probably wanted to go to a concert when I was a kid. All he's wearing is that T-shirt. His room is covered with nothing but these bands and everything. And we say, well, I think you should say something to him. Well, if we do, he might rebel and leave the church. You know, well, she's wanting to wear these little mini skirts. And she's wanting to show her midriff and show her cleavage and everything. Well, it's not how I want her to dress, but you know, if we start making rules, she might rebel and leave the church. Well, he's going over to these parties, and I know they're drinking at those parties, and these things are going along, and but don't want to tell him not to. He might rebel and leave the church. Do you suppose Satan really minds if people are sitting in a pew as long as they belong to him? That's probably not a big problem for him. And again, the church at Laodicea. What good does it do to be in church if we are not in the Lord? So we need to deal with those things. And sometimes there was one episode of the old Andy Griffith show where Barney was usually wrong, but on this one I think Barney was right. And you'll remember the phrase. Nip it. Nip it in the bud. Sometimes when you, part of being a parent is looking at trajectory. Not everything that's wrong for somebody is wrong for everybody. But it's like, let me illustrate that from Zacchaeus and the rich young ruler. When Jesus met Zacchaeus, did he tell Zacchaeus, you've got to give up all your money? No, he didn't. When he met the rich young ruler and saw his problem, what did he tell him to do? You need to give up your money. So there might be, you know, if my son's getting into basketball, or if he's getting into a band, or if he's getting to this, or if he's getting into that, and he has it in a proper place, but he still the Apostle Paul is still more impressive to him, you know, and what the Lord did is more important to him than this band member or something. That's one thing. But when it starts to be that's all they care about, their friends are all, guess what? We need to cut those things off before they get to be a bigger problem. And don't let them have privileges when they're not meeting responsibilities. Encourage them to meet the responsibilities, then they can have privileges that are appropriate. Don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility with God? James 4:4. Let me say just one word on attire and dress and stuff. I want you to picture a fence, okay? Somebody has in a neighborhood, houses are close together, they've got a swimming pool, and so that people are not going to see their daughters or the wife back there, they've got up a privacy fence. Might be a real nice redwood or something else. It's an attractive fence. It's a quality fence. What's the purpose of it? Privacy. You drive by a mansion, and it's got a wrought iron fence out front. Like this. You know, holes big enough for a German shepherd to jump through. What's the purpose of that fence? Is he trying to keep prying eyes out from seeing that gorgeous? No. He wants you to see and be impressed with that gorgeous estate. Those are two different kinds of fences. When you get your mail, sometimes you'll get something from the bank, and it's in a what? A security envelope. Now, there's a window that shows you the part that needs to be shown, right? They don't cover up the name and address. You need to know that. But the other part, it's not for your neighbors or the postman to see what your bank account number is or all that, right? Now, you ever get those flyers with all the coupons and it's all see-through and clear? Different purpose. Last illustration. Birthday present. It's nicely wrapped. It's very attractive. Beautiful. Has a nice pretty bow on it. But you're not supposed to see what's inside yet. Oscar Mayer bacon. That's a see-through wrapper. Why? Go ahead, inspect the bacon. We got too many people dressing like Oscar Mayer bacon instead of the opposite. And you know the different clothes that are out there, and they even have for little girls now, they have, you know, things that are just intentionally sexually suggestive. Think about what we're wearing. Think about what our children are wearing. And if we expect our children to get comfortable having on next to nothing, if we expect our children to be used to being around the other gender when they've got nothing more on than a little swimsuit, it's no more than their underwear, where is going to be their sense of embarrassment for them to have on more than just their underwear after they get in a car with some boy that they like? When we take away the opportunity to learn a sense of modesty and decency, we're setting them up for problems. You remember the one time in the Bible where somebody got dressed to go swimming or go to the beach? It was Peter. And what did he do? He put some clothes on. Because he's out there in the boat, and they'd strip down to just their undergarment for working men out there in the boat. But when Jesus was on the beach, what did Peter do before he went over there? He put some clothes on and went over there. All right, let's move on. I need to hit these next few a lot quicker. Assuming cultural norms. Oh, she's two. Oh, she's going to be terrible. You know what they say, the terrible twos. Oh, well, he's a teenager. He's going to be rebellious. Don't worry about that. They all are. You know what? A lot of two-year-olds are terrible if they're not trained. A lot of teens are rebellious if they're not trained. And what do they grow up to be, generally speaking? Ungodly adults. Well, if you want what's culturally common, if you want your child to be an ungodly adult, then say, I don't mind if they're terrible too. I don't mind if they'll be, because that's the way that road tends to go. It doesn't have to go that way. For example, Josiah. How old is he when he set his mind to follow God? 16. Because he was 8, wasn't he, when he became king and in the 8th year? 16 years old. How old was Timothy? When Paul, and Paul was not a terribly easy fella to impress sometimes. You know, John Mark didn't get to go on the second missionary journey, but guess who did? Timothy. Now, I don't know Timothy's age, but and I'm not sure how all the dates work, but it's often thought that Paul writes Timothy in the 60s. If so, it's in the 60s that Paul says, let no man despise your youth. If he's a youth in his 60s, how old was he in the late 40s when Paul picked him up? Timothy could have been a teenager. But he was a teenager, well reputed among the brethren, and Paul thought, I want to take him with me. As we know from some of the good young people that we have, two-year-olds don't have to be terrible. Teenagers don't have to be rebellious. And we don't need to listen to society saying, oh, well, that's just the way it's going to be. Number 15, going into defense mode when our children are wrong. I remember a good friend of mine, Lucky Stover, he said when he went to West Virginia, you'd have to know Lucky. He was so funny on so many levels. But he told me about growing up, one of 13 kids. He said, I went to school. He said, I didn't like it. So I just got up and went home. This was his first day of school. He said, my mama took me by the ear, whooped me all the way back to the school, took me in the classroom, handed me to the teacher, and told her to whip me again. He said, I didn't do that anymore. There was a time when if a child got in trouble at school, what was going to happen at home? They were going to be in trouble at home. And for those of you in the public school system, you know what often happens now. The child gets in trouble at school, and when contact is made with the parent, what do you hear? Either it is not my child, or you're failing to, you know, it's going into defense mode. A buddy of mine drives a school bus, and he said one of the kids had taken a Sharpie, you know, permanent marker, and just writing on the seats. So he has to call the mom. Oh, no, that was not my child. Yes, ma'am, it was. No, my child would not do that. It was not. Yes, ma'am, it was your child. No, it was not. My child did not do that. Ma'am, would you like to see the video? Her response was, what did you do that made him do it? What was not going to happen there? Accepting responsibility. That's what was not. So it was nope, 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 nope. Oh, then your fault. Let me tell you something. What message is that sending to that boy? We'll use Homer again. What message is that sending to Homer? I can do what I want to do, and mom's got my back. And you've seen those moms. You know, whether it's at a party or in the neighborhood or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I've had somebody tell me that they've had In the professional world, they've had, like, when somebody, you know, got fired or didn't get a promotion, they've had the mom call up and say, if any of those moms are here, just understand, rest of the world isn't going to buy in on that. You know, when lazy Homer gets fired and mom calls up and says, hey, why is it my boy's fault? The boss is not going to say, oh, I'm sorry. Bring him back and we'll give him a corner office. That's not going to happen. What can happen is that he gets used to mom bailing him out, and so later he needs mom bailing him out in a legal and financial, more serious sense of the word. Don't be to doing that. 1 Timothy 5:1, do all things what? Without partiality. When a class teacher comes to me and says, you know, your boy was climbing around under the tables, you know, during class and wouldn't stay in his seat, I'm saying, thank you for telling me. That's my friend for telling me that, because she knows I need to know that. And I wasn't in there, and so I need to know how he's acting around somebody else. That's my friend for telling me that. We don't need to blame the messenger. They're helping us out when they let us know those things. Isaiah said, woe to them that call evil good and good evil. Sometimes our kids are wrong, and it's not our job to say it was good because it wasn't, and it's not helping them at all. Number 16, failing to train humility. I have seen families that sacrifice for other people, families to whom coming to church was important, the Lord was important, and families that really valued, you know, they wanted their kids to learn the Bible, they wanted their kids to be involved, they wanted their kids leading Bible studies, leading singing, preaching, different things, and they're just really wanting this, but they leave out something really fundamental, and that's humility. Six, yea, seven things are an abomination to the Lord in Proverbs chapter 6. And what is at the top of the list? What's the first thing listed in those six, yea, seven abominations? A proud look, a haughty look. What was one of the problems with the Pharisees? Their arrogance. Let me tell you something. Some sins don't thrive in a religious setting, but pride can thrive in a religious setting just like mold in the bottom of the crisper drawer. You look at the Pharisees in the first century. God, I thank you that I am not like the rest of men, especially that guy over there. I fast twice in the week and I give a tithe. I am so good. Thank you. And if it's our goal, oh, I want my boy leading that. I want my boy leading. Oh, you should be leading that. Oh, if you're not teaching them humility. I had to deal with a couple of young men like this. And one of them, I remember talking to one time, because it just, but one of the things he told me on one occasion, one time he said, well, I'm a teenager. Of course I'm egotistical. Another time he said, I just like to be the center of attention. And when he led singing, you could tell. You know, that was, he really liked being the center of attention. Another fellow, the father was, oh, he's wanting his son to do this. And then a few years later, came to me. They weren't worshiping with us anymore at that point, but they were elsewhere. But he came to me, and he's troubled because he's having troubles with his sons. And he said, he's just kind of frustrated, and he doesn't know what to do and stuff. I said, let me ask you a few questions. We'll call him Homer. I said, and the boy had some qualities. I said, would you say Homer is zealous?
Oh, yeah.
Would you say he's intelligent?
Yes, yes.
Would you say he's conscious?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And then I asked the question that I was setting the whole thing up to make the point on. I said, would you say that he's humble? He went, no. That was the problem. He'd raised a very arrogant young man, and he had contributed to it. What does Proverbs say? Look at Proverbs here. Let's look at a couple of verses real quick. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 2. To know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction. Verse 5. Let the wise hear and increase in learning. But look at the end of verse 7. Who despises wisdom and instruction? Look at your Bible. Proverbs says, it's a very important point. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. Who despises correction? Fools. And we have to put our kids to the fool test. And sometimes when I put that test on some of my kids, some of them turn out to be fools. And sometimes when I put that test on me, I turn out to be a fool. And when we're being a fool, we need to stop. Over and over in the book of Proverbs, In chapter 9, it says, reprove a scoffer and he'll hate you. Reprove a wise man, he will love you. That was 9:8. 9:9, give instruction to a wise man, he'll be wiser still. So, put the fool test on your son or daughter. Stop and think. When I correct my son or my daughter, do they listen and become wiser and love me? Or do they hate being corrected? We can put this on ourselves too. Do you hate being corrected? None of us particularly enjoy criticism. But when the criticism is needed, we should what? We should value it. Where would we be without it? I need criticism. You need criticism. We need criticism. Constructive criticism in the ways of light to help us to see, oh yeah, this would be better. Oh yeah, that's not being good. Those things help us, and our children need to learn that too. And if we are raising a child who resents being corrected, then we need to back up and teach them humility. Because they have to be willing to be corrected. Otherwise, it won't matter how well they lead singing, how powerfully they preach, how much they give, how often they attend, or how nice they look to everybody else. Because if they're arrogant and will not listen to the correction of the word, that's the unrighteous, and that's the fool. We need to keep ourselves from being that and keep them from being that. Number 17, the mistake of focusing on home income over home outcome. The children. We talked about that this morning in how, like, with young people, think about, oh, we can afford this, 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 this. And before you know it, they've budgeted themselves into a situation where they bought so much stuff and put so much stuff on credit. Where's the time now for somebody to devote to raising that child? Be wise. I heard a financial advisor, I think it was with Focus on the Family, making it, I thought was, just doesn't have to be done this way, but it makes a whole lot of sense. He said, when you're both working before the children come, be learning to live on part of that income and putting the other way in savings or getting ready for a house or something like that, so that when the child comes, then mom can be with the child and you've already learned how to get by on this much, and so that you can be with that child. But too often, a lot of children are just not getting a lot of time with their parents. But we need to have all this stuff. We need to have that bigger house. We need to have that nicer stuff. We don't need all that. What our children need is us. You remember the boy I told you about, my friend in high school? His father had bought him two Mustangs. While he's in high school, he's got a Mach 1 and an older classic one. You know, who had that? He did. And what did he say? He said, my dad will buy me anything I want, but he would never spend time to go play catch with me. Our children need more of us and less of materialism. It is the home, not the house. It is the family, not the stuff. Do our homes reflect scriptural priorities or cultural priorities? What were older women to do? Train the younger women to love their husbands, love their children, be sober-minded, chaste, workers at home, kind, being in subjection to their own husbands. 1 Timothy chapter 6 says, if our intention is to be rich, that'll lead us into many, many snares. Now, it wasn't wrong to be rich. Job was rich. Abraham was rich. Later in the chapter in 1 Timothy 6, it says, remind the rich to do three things. Don't think you're better than other people. Don't have your hope set on it. And be generous. It wasn't wrong to be wealthy, but when that becomes our goal, and so the Lord and our children get put aside, if somebody walked up to you and said, I'll give you $250,000 for that child, would you sell your child? Nope. If somebody says, I'll give you this much money if you'll not take time to raise your child, don't do that either. underestimating threats. Any of these could be a long discussion. We're just going to mention them quickly. Corruption from entertainment media. Corruption from the internet, pornography. We've talked about that some already. If that's a problem in your home, get rid of it now. If that's a problem in your life, get rid of it now. And if you're one of those fellas that's been saying, well, yeah, that's something I battle. Yeah, I battle that. Yeah, I battle that. I want you to think about that word battle, okay? If we got Marines over battling the Taliban, what does it mean, battling the Taliban? It doesn't mean every other night they go out and help plant bombs with the Taliban. Yeah, battle the Taliban. No, no. Battling the Taliban means you're opposing the Taliban, not participating with the Taliban. Too many times, if we've got a sin we're refusing to repent of, we'll say, yeah, yeah, I struggle with that. You know, if I've surrendered to the other side and I'm defeated and doing whatever, that's not a big struggle, and that's not battling. We need to be battling. And as we said before, Jesus said, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. If that thing needs to be unplugged, unplug it. If that cable bill needs to be canceled, cancel it. If that internet connection needs to be cut off, cut it off. And if you need to go, you know, to without your iPad or whatever, go without your iPad. Certain educational agendas, relativism, promotion of homosexuality, evolution, etc. Offenders, predators, old and young. Because of internet pornography, there's a lot more people out there. Please understand how many people are damaged out there and being raised in dysfunctional homes, and children are being used by adults sexually, and then older children that are being used by adults are turning around and using younger children by adults. It's getting to be a huge, huge problem in this country. There was a time when you just say, oh yeah, we'll send the kids over for a spend the night party here or there or something. And doesn't have to be a spend-the-night party for some of the things that are happening and being done to church. And it's happened sometimes with people in churches. There was a fellow that wrote an article. He was a sexual predator, and he was in a church. And he said, this is what I would do. I would look at the children. I would choose who I was attracted to. And then I would look at the ones that did not have a strong family base at home, because he knew those would be the ones that would be vulnerable. There's a lot of predators out there. Don't presume medication solutions for behavioral issues. You, with your doctor, can make choices for your family. But let me tell you, not all doctors are saying the same thing, and not all doctors are effective. Luke was the good physician. But then you remember the woman who'd been to many doctors and wasted all her money, and they'd been able to accomplish nothing. You know, and they probably couldn't with the disease she had, and Jesus was able to fix it. Sometimes doctors have the answers, sometimes they don't. But do understand this. Our medical community is based on an evolutionary assumption. And that evolutionary assumption is not that there is sin and God and judgment. The evolutionary assumption is what? We are an accidental arrangement of chemicals. And so if we're an accidental arrangement of chemicals, and I'm acting in a socially not constructive way, what must be the problem? My chemicals. And so, how are we going to treat it? With chemicals. Now, are there chemicals, are there medicines that save lives and help people with difficulties? Yes, there are. But don't automatically assume just every time a doctor hands you a prescription, particularly when it has to do with behavioral issues. Give thought to that. You'll make decisions for you and your family. You can talk to a doctor, maybe you can talk to two or three doctors. But we live in a society now where everything is a syndrome. Somebody was telling me about their brother or brother-in-law involved in the school system. He said one child came in, you know, he was a brat. And the parent said, well, he suffers from episodic discontrol syndrome. that's called a brat. That's what that is. Everything's a syndrome now. And there are medical issues. There are different things. There's times when medicine saves lives and can help people different things. But don't just buy into the automatic, here's a pill, here's a pill, here's a pill. Feminism, blurring gender roles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Parents, take the time. Teach them to do right. Train them to do right. Expect them to do right. we're going to do one last one here, and then we'll be done. Lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. And it is so easy to do. And with six kids, and as many times I've made this point, my 18-year-old came home from college and said, "You're being too easy on the youngest one." All right? So I said, "Thanks for telling me." Lowering the bar from the firstborn to the baby. Do you remember when we studied Luke 15 this morning? Jesus didn't have to give a birth order in there, but he did. Who wanted all the money and went away and wasted it? The younger brother. This doesn't mean, every once in a while I'll meet like a younger or a middle child, and they seem like a first child personality, you know. And you don't have to fit what I'm about to describe, but it's very common. I remember one time I was talking with a woman, and one child, you know, she had a good marriage, they had a good business, beautiful home, nice kids, and another child was unemployed, living in the garage, smoking pot. And I said, "Is he your youngest?" And she went, "How did you know?" Because it's a pattern that repeats itself over and over and over and over. You'll see families where the older children, you know, "Oh, how's this one?" And, you know, "Oh, he's doing fine. He got a promotion, you know, and everything. And how's this one?" "Oh, they just got married, and she and her husband, you know, they're starting off and everything. How's that one?" "Oh, he's in school. He's doing this." And you get to, sorry if anybody's named Homer here, but we're going to keep with Homer. "How's Homer?" "He's doing well. Probation officer said this time, most of the time, he's showing up, you know, and, you know, he's not looking for a job yet, but we know it's stressful coming out of rehab." And the older kids are saying, "Why are you buying him a car?" "I didn't buy him that car." He's going to pay for it if he ever pays me back. You know, why does that happen? Let me suggest a few things. Number one, and of course, sometimes you can be the baby of the family and you're very responsible and do great things. I'm just saying, as parents, we need to give the same benefits of training to the baby that we gave to the first one. But let's think about why it's so real quick as we end. First off, percentage of time. Okay? If you've got four kids, baby number one comes along, how much of your parenting time is available for that baby? All of it. By the time baby number four comes along, how much of your parenting time is available? Not all of it. So that's one thing that can factor in. Also, how careful were you with that first child's pacifier? It's like the pacifier falls on the ground. Oh, all the germs that could be down there. You sterilized that thing. Or maybe you just threw it away. You know, the baby shower, there are lots of pacifiers. You got a new one because, oh, forbid that a germ should ever, you know, hit my baby. You know, and so you are really, by child number two, yeah, that's right, yeah. Child number three, let the dog lick it off. You know, it's, why? Because you learned that babies are a lot tougher than you thought. You know, because baby number one, you were so careful about the pacifier, and then he's licking a boot. You know, it's like, ah, he's eating out of a plant. He found some gum under a table, and he's chewing it. You know, and you're like, ah, and he didn't die. So you realize, you know, we were being overprotective on that pacifier thing, so that's why you can do this now. But here's another thing that happened with that child number one. Child number one, when somebody gave it something, she had to say thank you. No, no, no. Say thank you. No, no, no. She had to say thank you. She had to have a good memory. She had to say please. She, you know, he had to do this. He had to do that. And we were real careful about that. And then we go to restaurant and people saying, "What a good little boy. How'd you do that?" And so he lived, and everybody thinks he's wonderful. And so we think, oh, I didn't need to worry about it anyway. You see the mistake we just made? He did live, not because we sterilized the pacifier. Everybody thinks he's wonderful because we did do the training. But then we let up on both sides. And so then the next one, he doesn't have to say thank you. He doesn't have to say please. He doesn't have to obey. And then we get different results. Something else also. Firstborn came into a world, everybody else in the house is a what? An adult. So who are his role models? Adults. Baby in the family comes into a house, and have you ever noticed how much adults are, you know, the boys, they want to be grown up, they want to be like, they're trying to accomplish that, they've got serious goals and stuff, they're adult-minded. Last child comes in the world, and there's also a lot of what? Kids. And so they don't have the same peer thing, and so they're sometimes not as motivated to accelerate growing up as quick. But more serious than that is baby number one. You remember this. You had that first baby. Was that a smile? No. Was that a smile? No. And you can't wait to, and you got a baby book, right? And you're watching, and it seems like it's going to be forever before they smile. And then one day, finally, they smiled, and you got out the sticker, right? And you put that in there. And it seems like they're never going to walk. And they, oh, and you put it on the sticker. Seems like they're never going to be able to read a book. Seems like it took forever. And you had a sticker for everything, and you couldn't wait till they hit those milestones, right, moms? By the way, if I were to ask you to show me the baby book for the baby, yeah, here's something that happens. Then mama realizes, oh, they grew up quick. Wow, that happened a lot. She had child number two, child number three. Oh, they grew up so quick. And now the baby comes along, and mom decides what? I don't want this one to grow up too quick. So she's not in a hurry to get him potty trained because, I want him to stay in diapers a little longer. It's cute. And he gets to keep his pacifier longer. And he's cute. She wants to keep him. That's my baby. That's my baby. That's my baby. And then when he's 35 years old and he lives in the garage smoking pot without a job, and the rest of the family is saying, why are you enabling that? She says, don't you talk about my baby. He's not a baby. He's a bum. Living in the garage, smoking pot. Hopefully not still in diapers. But, you know what that baby needs? That last child, enjoy him while he's little. But that last child, he also needs to be potty trained. He also needs to learn to read. And he also needs to grow up and be a man. Or a young lady. And so we need to train them and expect things out of them like we trained the earlier ones and expected out of them. Thank you so much for your attention this evening. I'm just going to say one comment on this. If you've got a pleaser and a strong-willed, realize both of them need to be trained. They both need to be trained. Don't resent one. Why can't you be like that one? Probably a lot of great people in history were kind of independent and stubborn when they were little, but that it needs to be trained out so it's not selfishness, but there's some backbone in there that needs to be turned into backbone for God. And if they're a pleaser, that needs to be trained to have some backbone, or else they'll be trying to please everybody else all the time. And when they go to a party and somebody says, drink this or sniff this, they're going to want to please too. Both types of children need to be trained. Train up a child in the way he should go. Thank you so much for the time this weekend. As we sing this song about thy word is a light unto my feet, I want you to think about the fact that this was a pedestrian society. They didn't have street lights. They didn't have cars. And you would sometimes find yourself walking on a trail. And Proverbs says, the wicked walk in darkness, and so they don't know what they stumble at. I live near the Appalachian Trail. You don't want to go up and walk the Appalachian Trail at midnight without a light, because there's roots and rocks and stumps and stuff, and you're going to trip. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet. If you need to respond, you can do so as a stand and sing.